Tales.
It's Black History Month, and that means that we're going to get all of these same usual arguments that we always get between people. When's White History Month? We'll go up the cry, and the answers will be just as canned and typical. Every month is White History Month, and so on. There isn't an Asian History Month. There aren't history months for all kinds of other races, but still this argument that we have every year ends up around the same sort of talking points, the same back and forth, and it never really gets anywhere. All it does is sow dissent and division between people. That's what identity politics does. The retort, crudely expressed as "when is there going to be a White History Month," is actually a crude call for equality. If this one group is going to get special treatment, why can't we get special treatment for our group? And that was the idea, the impetus, the demand for fairness that lay behind Black History Month, before that was ever a thing. Should we teach the facts? Should we teach history or an history? A particular point of view, a set of carefully selected facts? I would tend towards the idea that we should teach things, report things as accurately as possible, and then allow people to come to their own conclusions. When we fixate upon meaningless characteristics, such as race, we can only end up sowing division. And the thing that led to it, the positive demand for equality that led to it, is now what leads to the objections. Then can we really say that we're being fair and equitable and treating people equally while we're making special exceptions? I don't think so. There shouldn't be a Black History Month. Black history should be incorporated into the general historical teachings in whatever country it's being done, which understandably is going to focus more on that country's history. Equality is not special treatment. It's not a Black History Month, then a White History Month, then an Asian History Month, then a Hispanic History Month. It's treating everyone the same. It's incorporating everyone's stories into a general corpus of teaching, of education, of understanding, so that everyone has a common basis to work upon, an understanding that they're all in this together. The demand for a White History Month and the demand for a Black History Month are both driven by the same positive idea that people should be treated equally, that everyone should have a fair shake. Fairness is an incredibly powerful driver in human psychology and in animal psychology. Humans are a cooperative species, and we rely on complex social interactions. This seems to be where the idea of fairness originates, though we do see it outside of primates. It's most commonly seen in primates. If you reward monkeys in an experiment disproportionately for performing tasks, the group that feels that it's being treated unfairly can throw fits, be angry, break things, smash things, or refuse to work. Refuse to do the task, unless they get paid, essentially, a fair number of banana chips for doing the task. And humans are really no different. We are hardwired to hate unfairness. Unless, of course, we happen to be on top at the time. That tends to ameliorate it somewhat. But some monkeys, just as some humans, will seek to redress the balance from the top. It's just harder. So this desire for equality, this desire for fairness, this desire for a fair shake seems to be baked in to our psychology and our being at the genetic level. It's something that has been selected for. Now, some people will argue that Black History Month or various other initiatives and so on are there to compensate for the past. But the minority group that is getting this compensation, none of them now were alive when things were different. And the supposed oppressor class, none of them were alive when this happened. Holding a group identity accountable for what their ancestors did is obviously profoundly unfair, and compensating a group that never suffered under the injustices of the past is also unfair, and this is why there is this instinctual resistance to it. And this is the major failing, I think, in what we call social justice and social justice movements and intersectionality and all of the things that have become buzzwords and tired cliches over the last decade or so. They create division. They claim to be seeking fairness and equality and egalitarianism, when in practice they do anything but. And the objections to it tend to tap into this primal desire that we all seem to have for fairness and equality. And the message of fairness and equality on the basis of race and gender and sexuality and all of these other axes, people have been sold on that for quite some time now, other than a few holdouts and extremists. And so weirdly, we find this old left idea of equality and fairness, social investment and so on, butting up against social justice just as much as the conservative and traditionalist point of view, albeit for very different reasons. We won the argument on fairness, on economic fairness, on political fairness, on equal rights before the law. Some of that's been rolled back a little bit, and there are fights to be had there, but all things considered, most people believe in these things. Even conservatives and traditionalists have been forced to bend the knee to the tidal wave of demands for equality and fairness. And yet we find these strange bedfellows on the old school or the dirtbag left, and on the more conservative or libertarian bent, fighting back against social justice. Because it's unjust, and it's not particularly social. This atomization of people into individual identity groups, setting them against one another, this runs counter to more overarching identities that both the old school left and the right talk about. On the right, you may find this expressed in terms of nationalism, the collective identity of people together as a national group. On the left, you will see the idea of class consciousness, which overrides ideas of race or gender or sexuality or whatever else. Whereas social justice sets people at each other's throats, creates the oppression Olympics, makes people fight to see who is the most oppressed. When you're sold on that fundamental left-wing idea of equality, of fairness, of equality before the law, of equal opportunities, then the demands of social justice run counter to that. They demand special treatment. They demand individual treatment. They demand that identity groups be treated in different ways according to where they supposedly lie on these axes of oppression. And this is inherently unfair, and to anyone who has bought into or been forced to buy into the older left-wing arguments of equality and fairness and so on, this creates a reaction, an objection to this, because this is no longer about fairness and equality and choice and freedom. It's about treating people with particular characteristics in a special way, which was the bad thing that we were fighting against before, the idea of hierarchies, or that there should be different rules for the rich or different rules for royalty if you want to go further back. So we've gone from demands for fairness in the old school left into demands for special treatment in the new left. And the particularly perverse aspect of this is that special rights and advantages, that's the genuine definition of privilege. Whereas simply being white or straight or cisgender is not a source of privilege in the proper sense of the word. Currently, we're all embroiled in the transgender arguments. And this is an extremely complex and nitpicky area filled with obnoxious activists, whether they be TERFs or trans activists, which makes it very hard to have any kind of nuanced or intelligent discussion around the issues, which touch on psychology and biology and our kind of social interactions in private spaces, such as bathrooms, where people are extremely sensitive about going to the toilet around other people and concerned for the safety of children and so on. To an extent, that is a kind of straw man, but there are people who are genuinely concerned by that sort of thing. And the confusion around language doesn't help either. Made-up pronouns are something that people seem to object to almost reflexively, because when you fiddle with language, you're fiddling with how people communicate with one another, the ideas that it can even be expressed to each other. And when you add in terms that people don't know or understand what they mean, and when that seems inherently ridiculous, well, you've got a long uphill climb ahead of you. And that's largely not down to trans people, but to non-binary people working in the same sort of space. Where it really seems to have come into a focus is in sport and in the use of bathrooms. The idea that is trying to be sold, whether you agree with it or not, that trans women are women, that not just their gender presentation is female, but that their sex is genuinely changed and is female, or male, vice versa, that's an incredibly hard sell to people, because they have to ignore everything they've ever learned. They have to ignore the biology that they can see exists. They have to ignore the science around chromosomes and so on. And they have to embrace the few edge cases in between, the intersex conditions and so on. It goes against what people can see, what people think. It's a hard sell to tell someone that a trans person's sex has genuinely changed. And trying to sell that idea has, I think, made things more difficult for transgender people. It has divided people into camps. It has called a lot of people bigots who are otherwise completely accepting of trans people, simply because they won't go all the way to ignoring the evidence of their own eyes or of science or something they intuit very deeply. Even people who are incredibly empathetic and understanding end up being labeled bigots simply because they're not willing to go the entire distance to that most extreme point of saying that someone's sex is genuinely different. That they're being told to ignore biology, that a penis isn't inherently male, that ovaries aren't inherently female. It's a big, big ask and a hard sell, and seems to be driving people to more bigoted and hardline extremes. As they're, you know, if they're being told that they're a bigot, they might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb, as the saying goes. But this is to completely miss the point, I think. We want a society that is tolerant of trans people, that allows them to use whatever bathrooms that they want. That is a much smaller demand, to say that these people feel that they're women, they've had psychological doctor's tests for dysphoria and so on, they've taken whatever steps that they have, and yet does it really cost us anything to be nice, to be accommodating, to be fair, to treat them as the gender they wish they were? Does that cost us anything? Is there not a humanity in us all that can be appealed to here? To say these people deserve their dignity. They should be able to use whichever bathrooms they happen to want to use. They should be able to live their lives in so much as is humanly possible, in the way that they want to, so long as it harms nobody. That appeal to fairness and to empathy and to tolerance seems to me to be a much easier sell than to tell people to give in and just say, no, they genuinely are female now. I mean, that gets us to the main goal that we're looking for of tolerance and acceptance in public life, while avoiding the problems inherent in insisting that someone's physiology, genetics, gametes, hormones are all suddenly and abruptly changed because for whatever reason, whether it's neurological and physical or whatever else, they want to be a woman. Then that should be enough. That should be sufficient. And it's a more practical and achievable goal. And it extols the virtues of tolerance and fairness and equality and personal freedom that has a more broad-based universal appeal. Whereas the arguments we're having currently, the absolutism and the extremism that we see currently, is only driving huge divisions. Now, TERFs are horrible, but they do have some arguments which we should at least be able to empathize with. There are those within these more extreme feminist movements who do have good reason in their past to fear men. It might be unfair, but they take this to an extreme to the point where they fear and even hate trans women because they see them as men. Surely we can empathize to a degree with their pain, and we can negotiate something between them and others. Those who are completely unwilling to negotiate, there's not anything you can do about. But there has to be some sort of middle ground. I mean, they will accept male allies to an extent. Can they not accept trans women allies to an extent, to some extent? Can they soften to just a little bit? And equally on the other side, can we not extend a hand of understanding that a lot of these people are in pain or have had terrible things happen to them in the past? Can we acknowledge and understand their trauma in the same way that we can acknowledge and understand the trauma of the life situation of being a trans person? Can TERFs accept and understand that it's a difficult thing to be, and that trans people deserve their empathy and compassion, whether they believe that they're women now or not? It seems to me that this common ground, this demand for equality, which goes against the demands of social justice movements, is much more practical and much more likely to succeed. And it's an old school leftist idea. As I'm recording this, recently Joe Rogan endorsed Bernie Sanders for being the Democratic candidate against Donald Trump. And this caused a huge fuss and reaction from the social justice left. I call them the pseudo-left because I believe that their acceptance and demand for hierarchies and special treatment and privilege and so on runs counter to basic and fundamental left-wing ideology and philosophy. But still, one of the chief criticisms of Rogan has been that he is transphobic. I don't think that he is. His concerns tend to lie around sport. And he believes that trans women who've gone through a male puberty, a male growth, tend to have higher degrees of hormone levels, muscle mass, reach, bone density, things like this, that this grants them, at least potentially, a really meaningful physical advantage, particularly in combat sports. And this is where ideology meets biology, where what we wish, what we think ought to be, runs headlong into what is. I don't think it's genuinely transphobic to be concerned about these physical differences. And there are physical differences between men and women. And trans women and trans men fall somewhere in between. How do you navigate that space? By shrieking at someone who is broadening the appeal of left-wing ideologies to a very big and rather mixed audience? or accepting and understanding that and having the debate and trying to find a middle acceptable ground. I mean, women above certain hormone levels are not allowed to compete in women's sports because of the advantage that it represents and the doping that it tends to represent. Would that be a starting point for a discussion on this? Could we have a separate category? But it seems to me that shrieking and complaining and demanding people be deplatformed or someone repudiate the endorsement that they've had, this doesn't seem to be, to me, to be useful. You know, there's a real opportunity here to get someone genuinely left-wing into the White House who will be good for everyone's rights, for equality for everyone, particularly economic equality. And yet the establishment on what passes for the American left seems determined to prevent Sanders from getting the nomination. And left-wing activists seem determined to hold on to some sort of moral high ground rather than to get someone left-wing elected. And this is a problem we just had very recently in the UK as well. Corbyn came under attack. And there seemed to be a desire on this modern pseudo-left to maintain some sort of moral purity rather than to do what was necessary to get into power and actually implement any of these left-wing ideas and policies. And indeed, Corbyn was an albatross around the party's neck, preventing it from having the best possible chance of getting into power. So do you want to win and implement some of your agenda, or do you want to be absolutely ideologically pure while having your opposition, who believe things fundamentally opposite to you, wielding power and making societal change? I realize I'm spending quite a lot of time here on the trans issue, but it is an exemplar of these problems and these divisions. Even more than sport, perhaps, is the sensitivity around toilets. This is something very personal, very vulnerable. Nobody likes to be seen going to the toilet, unless they're doing it for recreational purposes, of course. No judgment here, no kink shaming. And transgender people want to be free and able to use whatever toilets comply with their self-perception of their gender. But this is a very intimate, very personal, very delicate sort of space. And so some people object to this. They don't want what they see as being men or women using their bathrooms, being around them at their most intimate and vulnerable space. And also there is this perception that trans people are somehow perverted inherently by virtue of what they are. And this is a replay of an older problem around gay people. There was often this perception, this idea that gay men were necessarily predatory towards children, that they were necessarily paedophiles. And we seem to be having the same sort of issue here around trans people. Now, it wouldn't surprise me if a certain proportion of trans people were creepy perverts, because a certain percentage of all humans are creepy perverts. There may even be slightly higher amount of trans people who are creepy perverts because of the problems that they've had growing up, not fitting in their own body and experiencing prejudice and hatred. These things are likely to twist people, as is suppressing and repressing who you really are. So the long-term solution is to be as accepting and tolerant as possible, because that leads to less psychological harm. But I would like to ask these people who think that trans women and trans men must somehow inherently be perverts who are attracted to children. Okay, you're heterosexual, presumably. You know, you're attracted to women if you're a man, men if you're a woman. Are you attracted to children? Are you attracted to little boys and little girls? No? Well, trans people are just as likely as you to be attracted to underage boys or underage girls, right? So if you believe that this is such a problem, then you shouldn't be around children, right? Now, equally, I think we can understand how people are uncomfortable about this. If we understand that they haven't internally fully accepted a trans person's gender identity. And I think it's unfair to hate them for that. You can try to gently educate them or ask them, you know, in an emergency, if one set of toilets was out of order, would you be genuinely that against someone of the other gender using the same bathroom as you? I mean, there are stalls, you've got privacy, right? But just because someone's trans doesn't mean they're a pervert. But equally, I think we can understand why people worry about the safety of their children using restrooms or their own privacy using restrooms. You know, there's understanding to be had on both sides. And probably the ideal solution is the unisex bathrooms, where women get to see how the other half lives in our shit-smeared and piss-swilled toilets. Whether they'll want to do that, I don't know. But maybe it'll encourage people to keep unisex toilets cleaner and nicer than they otherwise would. What I'm driving at here, that the central point, the central thesis here is that it's much easier to appeal to people's sense of fairness and equality. And most people are already sold on those ideas. It's much harder to sell people on the idea that this group or that group should receive special treatment or special funding or special legal accommodations, privileges, in the proper sense of the word, just because of their identity characteristics, when previously we've spent so long saying that people shouldn't have special privileges according to these characteristics, that straight people, quite rightly, shouldn't have special rights, that cisgender people, quite rightly, shouldn't have special rights, that white people, quite rightly, shouldn't have special rights. But now we're saying the opposite for these minority groups, and however crudely put, the objection is that this is unfair, that this is not egalitarian, that this does not meet the very ideology that we have successfully sold the world on, by and large, at least in the West. When you understand it from that perspective, when you understand it from my perspective, it all makes a lot more sense. And the people objecting and arguing, however crudely misspelt or in all caps, what they're objecting to is something that runs against left-wing philosophy. And what they're arguing for, whether they're conservative or not, is the very equality and fairness that we spent so much of the 20th century battling for, fighting for, arguing successfully for. And when you understand it all from that paradigm, I think it all falls into place. And it is much easier to convince people to be compassionate and empathetic than it is to convince them that someone should be given privilege, or that they should ignore the evidence of their own eyes or of the scientific consensus or whatever else. If we sell it that way, we can achieve genuine social justice by binning what is called social justice currently. Consider poverty. People will say quite rightly that poverty disproportionately affects the African American community. Is this simply because they're black? Is it due to some inherent flaw in blackness? I would say no, given the opportunities, they're as likely to thrive as anybody else. But economic inequality, generational economic inequality, and lack of social mobility in the United States is what creates this and keeps it going, and also feeds into racism. America likes to see itself as a place where someone can succeed off their own merits. In fact, it's one of the worst nations in the West for the capacity to do this. It has some of the worst social mobility. Where do we find the highest social mobility? In socially democratic countries where there is large amounts of social investment in education and housing, issues like that. Now, if we take steps to address economic inequality, and if economic inequality disproportionately affects the African-American community, then we're naturally going to uplift the African-American community by addressing the poverty issue, which also affects people of any color, any identity group. So the end result is equality and fairness, but without any of the drawbacks that come inherent in social justice and intersectionality, without the identity politics that sets people against each other. Instead, you have a class consciousness, an understanding of each other, an agreement of fairness, where poor white families are getting help and poor black families are getting help and poor Hispanic families are getting help, and race does not factor into it. Race is not a factor in it, and everyone has an equal opportunity to succeed. I guess what I'm demanding here is pragmatism, radical pragmatism. You may feel that you're entirely right in insisting this, that, or the other, but you've got to make those ideas appeal to people. And we won the argument about civil rights, about legal equality, about economic justice, but we're losing these arguments about social justice issues because of the way in which the arguments are being conducted, the way in which they contradict the fundamentals of left-wing philosophy. And if we're going to win this round, we absolutely 100% have to focus on those original core values that the vast majority of people are now on board with: empathy, compassion, fairness, and opportunity, rather than division and one-upmanship, oppression Olympics, and the overriding importance of identity, because when you focus on identity, so do your enemies. Nationalists, populists, white supremacists. And their ideas are much easier to sell to people when the overriding atmosphere is one of identity politics. Zhang.
Grimm's Tales. Music by Casket Bound.